I rather doubt it.
Good Lord, gasped James. But you knew of this abomination?
From the beginning, said Holmes, no longer smiling. Far from being a villain seeking an inheritance, or whatever twaddle Watson added to distort the tale, the so-called Jeffro Rucastle, his real name Jethro Dawkins, was such an indulgent and loving father that he could not abide the thought of his daughter Alice, the murderer of his only son, the heir of the family name and title, being locked away in a bedlam. Thus the locked wing, the barred door. But if Miss Violet Hunter did not discover these things, if she already knew about Alice's madness, the reason for the locked wing and room, it was Peter Fowler, not the harlot Violet Hunter, who insisted on luring the Rucastles into town that March night in 1886. Holmes said grimly. He sent us a telegram stating his intentions of saving his beloved Alice. I sent him an immediate telegram in return, ordering him not to go anywhere near Hotchkiss Hall. He never received the telegram since he had already left his hotel in Wells, and Watson and I rushed out to Wookie Hole as fast as we could.
Wookie Hole? Chimed James.
Yes, of course. Close by the famous caves near Wells in Somerset. Fowler was staying in the Wookie Hole Hotel in Wells. Watson's fictionalized Rucastles were actually the well-known Dawkins family. Alice's father was Jethro Dawkins, Lord Hotchkiss of Hotchkiss Hall, first cousin to the Vicar of Wookie, and so-called hero of the Transvaal in the 1881 Boer Rebellion.
Even I, a mere American, have heard of the Witch of Wookie Hole, said James. His voice sounded strange to his own ears. He could not quite believe what he had just said. Henry James Jr., like his father Henry James Sr. and his older brother William, had always had a weakness for ghost stories.
The Witch of Wookie Hole is a limestone stalagmite that's been scaring tourists since the 1600s, Holmes said in the flattest of tones. Alice Dawkins was the real-life monster of Wookie Hole. And only 7 years ago.
Henry James squinted at Holmes. You said that Peter Fowler was murdered. It was written that Mr. Rucastle and this Dawkins, Lord Hotchkiss, died violently. There's a lot of yet unexplained mayhem there.
We arrived only minutes too late, Watson and I,
Holmes said in a barely audible voice.
Fowler had brought a tall ladder, risked the dangerous traverse across ancient slate tiles in the darkness, and let himself down to the small skylight in Alice's locked room. She must have sat on the bed in silence and let him unlock her manacles, padlocks, and chains while he whispered endearments. Then she used her teeth and uncut nails to slash his throat. She was eating his heart when Dawkins, her father, rushed in. The Violet Hunter, hired harlot, was close on Dawkins's heels, and, by pure coincidence, wearing Alice's blue dress that evening.
James sat, staring and waiting. Despite the fact that all this had to be pure invention, he found that he had trouble breathing.
Mr. Dawkins, Lord Hotchkiss, had brought a pistol with him, continued Holmes in the same flat tones. He had told me in an interview the week before that he was sure he could never use it on his daughter. No matter what new unspeakable actions she might undertake, he was correct. As Watson and I ran down the dusty hallway and shouted at him, Dawkins raised the pistol to his temple and blew his own brains out.
And Miss Violet Hunter? Asked James. The non-governess governess?
Mad, said Sherlock Holmes. She began screaming at the sight of what was transpiring in Alice Dawkins's room, and continues to scream to this day, although her asylum care is paid for by Lady Hotchkiss.
James smiled to show that he was not a total rube,
Rube. The word came from when a traveling circus had come to the outskirts of Newport when he was young. James hadn't thought of that word for years. He'd never used it in a story.
And what about Carlo?
He asked softly.
Carlo?
Said Holmes.
In The Adventure of the Copper Beeches, Watson writes about Carlo, the giant baying mastiff that prowled the yard at night, and that tore out Mr. Rucastle's throat in the end.
Holmes smiled thinly.
Baying mastiff. Watson never has been able to tell his hound group from his herding dogs. Watson just doesn't know dogs. There was a mastiff at Hotchkiss Hall. His name was Barney. He was 15 years old, and if he'd encountered a burglar in the night, Barney would have rolled over to have his belly rubbed. The only infamy Barney ever committed, according to Jethro Dawkins when Watson and I spoke to him 3 days before he died, was when he playfully chewed up one of Lady Hotchkiss's stuffed animals.
But Watson wrote in The Adventure of the Copper Beeches that he had to take his service revolver and, I quote, blow the creature's brains out after it had killed Mr. Rucastle,
said James in a strained voice.
It was Mr. Dawkins's revolver, and I used it, said Holmes. Alice Dawkins was preoccupied with devouring her father when I took the fallen revolver and blew her brains out.
The two men sat in silence for several minutes. Finally, Sherlock Holmes, or the man pretending to be the imaginary Sherlock Holmes, said,
I believe I understand why Watson felt he had to write about the Wookiee Hole affair, the so-called Adventure of the Copper Beeches. It haunted him, bothered his sleep. It's in Dr. Watson's nature to try to rearrange things into simpler stories of right and wrong. But if I were he, I would have left the entire Wookiee Hole business alone.
Henry James looked the other man in the eye and said,
You realize, of course, that everything you've told me here sounds absolutely insane.
Absolutely, said Holmes.
The detective checked his watch.
John Hay said that a light lunch would be set out in the conservatory dining area at noon, and for us to go ahead even if he were still busy. Would you care to join me, Mr. James?
I'll wait until tea with Clarence King and dinner with the Norwegian emissary, Mr. Holmes, said James.
He said nothing else before going back to his room to lie down on the perfectly white bedspread. Chapter 16. Clarence King arrived promptly upon the chime of 5 p.m. A portly 51-year-old now, and long past his once athletic, mountain-climbing physical prime, King appeared at the Hayes threshold wearing a large beret and a well-worn green velvet corduroy suit, complete with knee breeches and high wool socks.
Your old European traveling suit, cried John Hay, fervently using both hands to shake King's. Are you going abroad again? Not unless one counts Mexico as abroad, laughed King in a voice Henry James found as velvety as the absurd traveling suit, and just as well-worn. I found myself traveling through Washington with no other clothes available, and knew that my oldest friends would understand this velveteen invasion. Consider it a tardy celebration of St. Patrick's Day. You could have worn your old cowboy breeches and chaps and been dressed perfectly for this home, Clarence, said Hay,
who had already made the dinner less formal by decreeing it only black tie rather than white tie, even with a Norwegian emissary and his wife and daughter attending. King whipped off the oversized beret and handed it to the waiting servant. James noticed that Clarence King's hairline had receded considerably since the writer had seen him last, leaving only the graying hint of what had once been long golden locks. King still wore a beard, clipped closely in the U.S. Grant manner that had long since gone out of style for younger men. Combined with the velvet corduroy suit, thought James, the beard and added weight made the explorer look not a little like paintings of Henry VIII. Then again, realized James, some had almost certainly made the same comment about him. James and Holmes stood and watched Clara Hay hug and kiss their old family friend with an almost girlish enthusiasm that struck both men as very un-Clara Hay-ish.
"Clara, my dear," cried King, "you remain the truest and brightest ray of sunshine in this old man's too clouded life. You have, as you know," and here King shot an almost boyishly mischievous glance at John Hay, "ruined for me all other members of your sex. I must now remain a bachelor for all my remaining days, looking forward only to cremation, since that alone guarantees to be a new experience."
"Oh," cried Clara Hay, and slapped King on his green velvet corduroy sleeve.
"Harry, by God," cried King, shaking Henry James's hand with great animation. "Adams has so far won the race to baldness amongst our band, but I see that you and I are finally giving old Henry a run for his money. What brings you out of the London fog and back to the States, my friend?"
"First and foremost," James said softly, retrieving his hand and resisting the urge to rub circulation back into it, "this chance to see old friends. May I introduce a traveling companion and fellow guest, Mr. Jan Sigerson? Mr. Sigerson, I present to you the original and inimitable Clarence King. Mr. King, Mr. Sigerson." King shook hands, but then took a step back in the huge foyer, as if needing to give Holmes a second inspection.
"Sigerson? Jan Sigerson? The Norwegian explorer? The fellow who just a couple of years ago penetrated deeper into the Himalayas than any white man has been known to go? That Jan Sigerson?"
Holmes bowed modestly.
"By God, sir," boomed King, "it is a pleasure and honor to meet you. I have 1,000 questions for you regarding the Himalayan mountains and the forbidden land you managed to penetrate. While I misspent my youth clambering up this continent's molehills, you, sir, have gone to real mountains."
"Only to their most modest passes, Mr. King," said Holmes in his Norwegian accent.
His dark mustache seemed thicker this evening, and James actively wondered if he'd touched it up somehow.
"And even then, on the backs of ponies." "Come into the parlor, King," cried John Hay, obviously delighted to see his friend.
But there was something else that James was picking up from their host. Embarrassment at the way their friend was dressed? Some unfinished and probably unnameable business between the two? Money borrowing, perhaps? As portly and ruddy as King appeared upon first glance, a closer inspection suggested that he had recently passed through an illness, perhaps a serious one.
"It is tea time,"
exclaimed Clara Hay. Clarence King smiled almost sadly.
"Ah, those were the days, Clara. John leaving the State Department early, choosing to leave the nation to unintended wars and misdirection rather than miss our 5 o'clock tea. And Adams poking his pale dome out of his study precisely at 5. Nothing else would have separated him from his lamprey-like attachment to his moldy green books. And Clover laughing and leading us into the fireplace room where the little red leather chairs awaited."
King seemed to notice the effect his eulogy was having on the company, and immediately lightened his tone and expression.
"Actually, John, I was hoping that we might substitute some of your sherry for tea this one afternoon."
"And so we shall," said Hay, putting his arm around King and leading the way into the fireplace-dominated parlor. "And so we shall."
Sitting, sipping his tea, they had poured sherry, but he would have it after the tea, Henry James was reminded of how small all 5 of the 5 of hearts had been. Clarence King, at 5'6",
had been the tallest of all of them. After some friendly chatter, Hay probing as to whether King was off that week for a diamond mine in the Andes or a gold mine in the Alaskan Rockies, to which Clarence King had replied only,
"Neither, a silver mine in Mexico."
King asked Holmes a few questions about the Himalayan peaks. Holmes seemed to answer, albeit vaguely, but then the two men began discussing exploration in earnest. James waited for the inevitable revelation that Sherlock Holmes could not tell the difference between a Himalayan peak and a Herefordshire hillside.
"I read your book,"
Jan Sigerson said almost diffidently to King.
"Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada. I enjoyed it immensely."
"That old tome," laughed King. "It's more than 20 years out of date, and half the chapters are about my early Pleistocene period around the summer and fall of 1864. But tell me, Mr. Sigerson, did you enjoy the section where I described conquering Mount Whitney?"
Sherlock Holmes only smiled. John Hay said, "Now, Clarence."
"I used 2 chapters to describe clambering up Mount Tyndall," boomed King. "Half the book to describe hiking all over other peaks around Yosemite, but only 2 subordinate clauses to describe my triumph atop the mighty Mount Whitney." "Not all peaks are ascendable upon one's first attempt," Holmes said softly.
King laughed and nodded. To Henry James he said,
"Here were my 2 subordinate clauses in toto, Harry, and I quote, 'After trying hard to climb Mount Whitney without success, and having returned to the plains.'"
King was the only one in the room laughing, but that did not seem to inhibit his mirth. James watched him closely, seeing the deeper bitterness that had settled into the old friend of his old friends. No, more a damp rising from within than something settling from without, as Dickens used to describe the damp rising from tombs under an old church until it chilled the entire congregation.
"Young, fit, outfitted, motivated to greatness," said King. "And not only could I not get within 400 feet of that summit on the first attempt, but when I finally returned and climbed it, it was the wrong mountain. Somehow, in the exertion of the climbing, I'd managed to misplace an entire mountain, all 14,500 feet of it."
"But you did return again and make the summit," John Hay said softly.
"Yes," said King, "but only after other white men had joined the Indians who'd made the summit before I did. And I named the mountain."
"And you have one named for you," said Holmes, "Mount Clarence King. Northwest of Mount Whitney, in the Sierra Nevada range, I believe. Our exploration group was keen on naming mountains after one another," said King,
holding out his sherry glass so the silent but ever-present male servant could refill it.
"It's called Mount Clarence King because there was already a peak in the Yosemite named after a preacher called Thomas Star King. My hill is 12,905 feet tall. Somehow, I always manage to be the runt of the litter. How high was that pass you crossed to get into Tibet from Sikkim, Mr. Sigerson?"
"Yelep La," said Holmes. 13,999 feet at the pass's summit."
"Admit it now," said King. "Weren't you a tiny bit tempted to pile up a little rock cairn, just a foot or so tall? Then you could have said you summited a 14er. 14ers are highly thought of in the American West."
Without waiting for an answer, King began to question Sigerson Holmes about climbing. It was almost a staccato interrogation. Holmes answered each question promptly and succinctly, evidently understanding the terms well enough. Sometimes he posed counter-questions that made Clarence King laugh, and say that he'd been burrowing into and under mountains the last 2 decades or so, not climbing them. James could only note the arcane terms that were filling the air. Belay, being on belay, going off belay, debating the best new forms of belay, rappelling, rappel ropes, anchors high and anchors low, stemming and counterforce, mantling, methods of chimneying, fist jamming, using one's bootlaces for prusik knots when dangling from a rope after a fall from an overhang. James understood none of it, but Holmes made it sound as if he understood it all. Finally, Clarence King sighed.
Well, I leave the mountains to you younger generation of climbers. My days on belay, or being belayed, are finished, I fear.
Rather than let this set the tone again, John Hay said to King, I'm sure Adams will be damnably sorry he missed you.
As well he should be,
muttered King, holding his glass out for another refill of sherry.
You should tell our other guest of how you met Henry Adams, said Hay.
Clarence King seemed to ponder a minute on whether it would be worth anyone's time to hear the story, but then he drank down his sherry and turned to Holmes.
You've not met Adams yet, is that right, sir? I've not yet had the pleasure of making his acquaintance.
King grunted.
Way back in 1867, not being able to find honest work, and not especially wanting to, I convinced Congress to create a survey of the 40th parallel and to put me in charge of it. In 1873, I was headed from Cheyenne, Wyoming, to Long's Peak in Colorado Territory to meet up with one of my partners, a certain Arnold Haig. Do you happen to know about Long's Peak, Mr. Sickerson?
No, said Holmes.
It's one of those much-loved Colorado 14ers. 14,093 feet, I seem to remember, named after Lieutenant Long of Zebulon Pike's expedition, and it happens to be at the easternmost bend in the spine of the Rocky Mountains in all of North America, which is all irrelevant to my story.
James smiled. He'd almost forgotten how Clarence King had the born raconteur's ability to let his tales meander like a mountain stream without making his audiences impatient. James had often pondered why that gift never translated from verbal storytelling to the written page.
Anyway, I'd only reached the valley of Estes Park by the time the sun had set that night, when I was trying to get to Long's Peak. So I got the loan of one of the little shacks there in which I could spend the night. Well, the shack had a bed, but no stove, and the night was cold. I was shivering under every blanket I'd brought with me when I heard this sound from outside, and I carry a lantern out, and there's Mr. Henry Adams on muleback. I'm not sure which one looked more relieved to have found a human habitation, Adams or his mule. At any rate, Henry had just finished his first year as an assistant professor of history at Harvard, and had recently become interested in geology after writing an article about the British geologist Charles Lyell for the North American Review. A friend had suggested to Adams that he come out west for the summer to see the work of our survey party, so he had. I guess Henry figured that there had to be some geology involved in so much surveying. Adams actually knew Arnold Haig from Boston, and had been hanging around his camp on Long's Peak when Henry decided that he'd board a mule and do some fishing. Naturally, he got lost, but Adams had the good sense to give the mule her head. If there's one sure way to find cooking and civilization, it's by giving a hungry mule its head. So he ended up at my little cabin in Estes Park at about 10 o'clock at night.
Here Clarence King grinned, and James could see that John and Clara Hay were smiling in anticipation of the finale of the explorer's little story.
I'd actually briefly crossed paths with Henry before that night, continued King, once in Washington and again in Cheyenne the week before this, but I didn't think I knew him well enough for the giant bear hug he gave me when he got down off that mule
and came into the light of that cabin. Henry had grown hungry, and I imagine a mite anxious. Anyway, Estes Park is high up, and it was a cold night for August. It can snow in August up there. So after sharing some cold beans, we crawled fully dressed into that bed, the only one the cabin had to offer, naturally, and talked almost till dawn. We've been fast friends ever since.
Adams will be so sorry he missed you, said John Hay.
Yes, sirree, but I have to get to that silver mine in Mexico or head back to the High Sierras and find gold if I'm ever going to add a constable to my turners.
John Hay smiled at Holmes. Harry knows this story, but it's worth repeating. Some years ago, Clarence was in England buying art, amongst other things, and Ruskin had two wonderful turners for sale. When he asked King which one he wanted, Clarence bought both, saying, "One good turner deserves another." King smiled wanly.
In those years, I was buying twin turners. These days, I am forced by penury to come to my best friend's formal dinner party in a faded velvet corduroy traveling suit.
Corde du roi, murmured Henry James, the corded cloth of a king, and such a beautiful whale.
Those were Captain Ahab's last words before Moby Dick sank the Pequod out from under him, said King.
When Holmes raised one eyebrow in query, John Hay said, "It was a novel that came out more than 4 decades ago and wasn't really noticed by most readers and reviewers, but Clover had recommended it, and all of us in the Five of Hearts loved it and referred to it frequently. It's about Ahab, a whaler sea captain who becomes obsessed with a white whale that took his leg years earlier.
Ahab's policy toward his white whale has become my attitude toward life in general these days," said Clarence King.
"Which policy is that?"
asked Henry James.
"To the last I grapple with thee. From hell's heart I stab at thee. For hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee,"
recited King, leavening the ferocity of the statement with a boy's sweet smile. Clara Hay, who had slipped out of the parlor a few minutes earlier, returned with her hands clasped together. Her smile was radiant.
"Emissary Helmer Halverson Volebeck, Mrs. Volebeck, and their daughter have arrived. It's a bit crowded and warm in here, so I thought we might take our drinks into the conservatory. Cook assures me that dinner will be ready in less than an hour."
Chapter 17. Henry James had known an elderly duchess who may have been the cruelest person he'd ever met. When she returned for the London season after months in Venice, her habit upon arriving at her town home was to throw an initial dinner party that might have been designed by the Borgias. James had been invited to one of these autos de fe to fill out the complement of bachelors at the table, and perhaps as part of his role, to serve as observer of the rites of cruel sacrifice to be explored that night. And although he'd long since been forewarned of the Duchess's venom, he had attended out of sheer curiosity. The turn of the social screw at the dinner party he had attended, including inviting 5 couples who, although none of them rising to the Duchess's social circle and not socially acquainted with one another, were comprised of 4 of the women having illicit affairs with no fewer than 5 of the men present. In addition were the brace of bachelors, Henry James foremost amongst them in both age and social ranking, and 5 unmarried young ladies, each of whom, the Duchess well knew, were or had been involved in disastrous liaisons with some of the single or married men. In no case was the spouse aware of the connections with others at the table. That dinner had been fairly leaking with tensions, but Henry James found himself far more tense at this cozy dinner on Sunday, March 26, 1893, where the Hayes, perhaps the least cruel couple James had ever known, were happily hosting their old friend Harry, Mr. Sigerson, Clarence King, and the Norwegian emissary and his wife and daughter. The emissary, Mr. Helmer Halvorsen Volebeck, was not the ambassador to the United States from the Kingdom of Scandinavia, only because King Oscar II of Scandinavia preferred to have two emissaries in Washington at all times, one from Sweden and one from Norway, titularly united under Oscar II, but still proud of separate origins. And currently, the Swedish emissary was the official Scandinavian ambassador. In 2 years, it would be Mr. Volebeck's turn. James judged Volebeck's age at around 60, but his wife, Linnea, if James had heard correctly during introductions, must have been at least 20 years younger. Their daughter, Oda, who was also present, was in her late adolescence and was reputed to be the most sought-after debutante on Embassy Row. They all spoke English flawlessly. James was disappointed, or perhaps relieved, it was hard for him to record his emotions at the moment, when Sigerson was introduced to Mr. Volebeck, and the two men clicked heels and bowed at the same moment, but exchanged greetings in English. The early courses were passed in easy conversation. John and Clara Hay were experts at involving everyone at a table in conversation. The only element even approaching politics was the Volebecks' united enthusiasm at the pageantry of Grover Cleveland's inauguration a few weeks earlier, and their eagerness to look in on the Columbian Exposition, Chicago's World Fair, in May, before they returned to Norway for the summer. Miss Volebeck appeared to have given her attention only to the many inaugural balls around the city that night and weekend of March 4th.
Oda is of the age now where every ball is an opportunity to meet eligible young men, said Mrs. Linnea Volebeck in her soft Scandinavian accent.
Mother,
cried Oda, blushing fiercely.
Well, it is true, is it not?
Laughed her father.
Emissary Volebeck dabbed at his lips with the napkin.
My baby girl will soon be finding herself a husband.
While Oda blushed more deeply, Clara Hay smiled and said,
Why, we have two of America's most eligible bachelors at this table, Your Excellency.
When Mr. Volebeck raised an eyebrow in polite interrogation, Clara went on,
Mr. James and Mr. King have long been considered prize catches for the young lady who finally lands one or the other.
Is this true, Mr. James, Mr. King?
Asked Mrs. Volebeck in a tone that actually sounded interested.
Are you both still eligible bachelors?
Henry James hated this. He always hated it when he was teased about this at someone's table. He'd been irritated by it for decades, but at least he knew his response by heart. Smiling softly and bowing his head ever so slightly, as if he were being knighted by the Queen, James said,
Alas, I am on the cusp of turning 50 years old, and at that age an old bachelor may no longer be called eligible, but rather confirmed. It appears all but certain now that the only marriage I shall enjoy in this lifetime is to my art.
When he saw a flicker of confusion in Mrs. Volebeck's lovely eyes, he added,
To my writing, that is, since I am only a poor scribbler and currently a playwright. Mr. James, as I believe I mentioned to you, my darlings, said Mr. Volebeck, is one of the greatest of all living American writers.
James bowed his head again in response to the compliment, but smiled and said,
Based on sales of my work in recent years, my publisher, alas, again, even my readership, might well disagree with you, sir, but I thank you for your generous words.
And how about you, Mr. King?
Teased Mrs. Linnea Volebeck as she leaned forward over the table, the better to see the geologist explorer. The emissary's wife was still young enough to be attractive when she teased in a coquettish manner.
Are you wed to your profession?
Clarence King raised his glass of wine to the lady.
Not in the least, ma'am. My problem is that I keep being introduced to the loveliest young ladies in New York, Boston, and Washington, including, of course, now to your truly beautiful daughter, Oda.
King raised the glass higher and then drank from it while poor Miss Volebeck began blushing wildly again.
But, as our friend Harry puts it so well. Alas,
continued King,
all of America's and England's and Norway's finest beauties are so wonderfully pale, while some strange inclination in my makeup has made the dusky ladies of the South Seas the avatar and pinnacle of feminine beauty for me.
John Hay began to laugh at this, and most people at the table joined him.
Have you been to the South Seas, Mr. King?
Asked Mrs. Vollebeck.
Alas, no,
said King with a mischievous smile. He was obviously enjoying tweaking at James for using the lady poet's word.
But Henry Adams and John Lafarge spent a couple of years traveling from island to island in the Pacific, sending me long letters describing the beauty of the dusky ladies there.
He finished his wine.
Darn their mangy hides.
John Hay nodded to a servant, and everyone's wine glasses were refilled in an instant.
Clarence has been to Cuba and the Caribbean, said Hay.
And to Mexico and Central America and points south of there. But, alas,
he bowed his head in a caricature of defeat.
To Mr. King finding his dusky beauty,
said little Oda as she raised her refilled glass, and after everyone laughed long and heartily at the young lady's pluck, they toasted King. The primary courses were arriving. James found himself agitated with impatience and his appetite depressed as he waited for the inevitable unveiling of Jan Sigerson as a humbug. He also realized that he was motioning for his own wine glass to be refilled more than was his usual practice at dinner. Suddenly, the focus turned to Clarence King again, and the men, and even Clara Hay, were taking turns trying to explain the 1872 Great Diamond Hoax, and King's role as hero in it, to the female Vollebecks. Mr. Vollebeck required no tutorial, since it turned out that his uncle had been in New York at the time, and had been eager to be an investor in the miraculous Diamond Mountain, somewhere in western Colorado. King's first role had been in finding the mesa-shaped mountain and proving that it was all a hoax. The diamonds, rubies, and other gems found there were real enough, at least $30,000 worth, but they were low grade and purchased in London by the men seeding them, just as others had blasted real gold into played-out gold mines in Cripple Creek and elsewhere to make millions from their $30,000 investment. Clarence King had saved Helmer Halverson Vollebeck's Uncle Halvard and scores of American millionaires and eager would-be investors from losing their trousers in the hoax.
But had not Mr. Tiffany of New York certified that the diamonds and other gems found on the mountain were worth huge fortunes? Asked Mrs. Vollebeck.
He did indeed, said King. But it turned out, as I knew even while Mr. Tiffany was certifying them being worth millions, that the jeweler and his associates had no real experience with uncut diamonds.
When you found the mountain, Mr. King,
queried Miss Vollebeck in her delightfully accented tones,
what, how do Americans say it, what tipped you off that the stones had been planted there?
King laughed so richly that others joined in for no reason.
My dear young lady, he said at last, we arrived at the so-called Diamond Peak on an early November day so cold that our whiskey had frozen in its bottles. We got off our mules on a bare, iron-stained strand of coarse sandstone rock, about 100 feet long, and we could not put our boot soles down without dislodging a diamond or other precious stone. At first, we ran around like children at Christmas, seeking out gems and diamonds as fast as we could. But then my scientific training took over. I noticed that we never found the valuable stones at any place where the earth had not been disturbed. We were finding rubies in anthills, for instance, but only in anthills that two holes, one where the ants came and went, and another, smaller break in the crust on the opposite side. I immediately understood that someone had been pushing the rubies in with a stick. diamonds, rubies, and other valuable gems are never found together in such profusion, Miss Volbeck. And to prove this to the men in San Francisco and elsewhere who were so eager to buy shares in the fraudulent mining corporation the hoaxers had set up, my friends and I spent 2 days digging a trench 3 feet long and 10 feet deep down in a gulch where, if this was truly a diamond peak, hundreds of diamonds should have been found beneath the surface. Instead, nothing.
John Hay held his glass of wine in both hands. And so young Clarence King was aware 3 more days and nights hurrying back to San Francisco, not only to prevent the investors from losing millions, but to stop speculators from scoring big by selling short on the stock. Hay lifted the glass.
To an honest man.
To an honest man, said everyone save for Clarence King, and lifted their glasses to him. King's blush was visible, even through his deep tan.
Now, said His Excellency Emissary Volebeck, when the main course had been served and a temporary hush had fallen over the table,
I would beg everyone's apology for my rudeness, but I would like to address my fellow countryman, Mr. Sigerson, in our native language for a moment or two.
By all means, cried Hay.
Henry James set his own glass down and found that his hand was shaking. Mr. Volebeck leaned across the table toward Sigerson Holmes and unleashed a rapid-fire volley of rather melodious Norwegian. Sigerson looked as if he were about to speak, but then said nothing. Volebeck followed up with another paragraph. Sherlock Holmes still remained silent. James realized that his heart was pounding, as if it wanted to escape his ribcage. In seconds, it would be revealed that the man he had brought into the family circle of his dear friends the Hayes was an imposter, and it would be equally obvious that James had known that Sigerson was an imposter. Or would it be so obvious? James looked at the suspended moment as if it were a scene in one of his novels or short stories. How should his character respond to the coming revelation, a hoax much more damaging to those at this table than King's long-ago Great Diamond hoax? James could feign the shock and surprise and anger that the others here, especially John and Clara, would actually be feeling. But then Holmes might very well reveal everything, James's complicity from the beginning, and James would have to choose between calling the uncloaked Sigerson a liar, pistols at dawn at 20 paces, or simply apologizing profusely with whatever dignity might remain, announce that he would leave Washington that very evening, and leave the table after bowing in apology to everyone there. James felt sick to his stomach. He was sure that Holmes would explain their ruse in terms of solving the mystery of Clover Adams' suicide, and he knew that this would send another seismic tremor of shock through the haze, which would be nothing to the level of shock and betrayal that Henry Adams would feel next week when he arrived home to hear this terrible story from his neighbors and intimate friends. Henry James had not forgotten that Clover's death was so traumatic to Adams that his historian friend had never once mentioned the day or details of her death in the more than 7 years since the event. James felt actively dizzy as the nausea and excess of wine mixed to make the table and all the silent waiting people around it seem to rise and fall before him. He set both his palms flat against the white linen, pressing down hard to try to stop the vertigo. Then Holmes Sigerson began to speak. Sounded like Norwegian to James, and while Holmes started speaking slowly, the trickle of what sounded like Norwegian soon turned into a torrent. When Holmes paused, Mr. Volebeck asked a fast question in even more rapid Norwegian, and Sigerson replied at the same rate. A long few paragraphs in a language that Henry James refused to believe that Sherlock Holmes had picked up in a quick study session or two. James looked at the two Volebeck women, but mother and daughter's faces showed interest, not astonishment or disbelief of any sort.
Emissary Vollebæk apparently posed another question. The Norwegian explorer, Sherlock Holmes, laughed and responded for half a moment in the quick, fluid language of Jan Sigurdsson's supposed homeland. As a writer, Henry James often, more frequently than not, if truth be told, felt somewhat detached from events and conversations occurring around him. Even as he worked at being a man on whom nothing was lost, the world often seemed more like a template for fiction than something that should be indulged in for its own sake. But this Sunday evening in March, James felt as if he had completely floated out of his body and were hovering over the table, a ghost watching the still living, chatting in an indecipherable language, or perhaps like a spectator at a play, the way he felt while watching the touring acting groups in England rehearse or actually act the lines from his first effort, The American. Detached, critical, unconvinced, but strangely enchanted, except that now he felt convinced and horrified. Emissary Helmer Halvorsen Vollebæk turned to the Hayes, King, and James and said, "Again, I apologize for the rudeness of us speaking our native language, and thank you for your patience and kind indulgence. But speaking to Mr. Sigurdsson has convinced me of something I only guessed at before hearing him speak. Things are not completely as has been represented regarding Mr. Sigurdsson." James felt his breath catch in his throat. So, Holmes's attempt at Norwegian had been deficient. How could it not be? An Englishman can't fool a Norwegian into believing that he, the Englishman, is a native Scandinavian. James had simply been disoriented by Holmes's whole-throated attempt. "We had read and heard that Mr. Sigurdsson was a Norwegian explorer," continued Helmer Halvorsen Vollebæk in an apologetic tone. "But after speaking with him for only these few minutes, my family and I realized that Mr. Sigurdsson is almost certainly the preeminent explorer from our nation at the present time. The London and American papers spoke of Mr. Sigurdsson's penetration of certain mountain ranges in India, but we had no idea of how unique and spectacular his explorations into Tibet in the past 2 years truly were. Also, Mr. Sigurdsson is from Løiten, my own tiny hometown in Hedmark County. Fewer than 100 people live there, and Mr. Sigurdsson grew up knowing my cousin Knut, who still lives there." Holmes said something brief in Norwegian. Mr. Vollebæk laughed. "Oh, yes, and my Aunt Oda, after whom our daughter was named." "Incredible coincidence," said John Hay.
"I always say it's a small world," said Clara Hay. James felt that he might be having a heart attack. His chest felt so constricted that he had to will himself to breathe in and out. "I asked Mr. Sigurdsson about his surname," continued Vollebæk, "since Sigurdsson is not a common Norwegian name, or at least not a common spelling of it. As I expected, and as Mr. Sigurdsson explained, his family name had been Sigurdsson, but his grandfather had married a German lady. They had lived a few years in England, and the spelling had been changed for convenience sake during that time, and never changed back." Henry James's mind was churning. Obviously, Jan Sigurdsson, or Sigurdsson, was not the English consulting detective impersonating a Norwegian explorer. Rather, Jan Sigurdsson Sigurdsson was a real Norwegian, a real explorer, who, for reasons probably not sane, was pretending to be the most likely fictional English personage known as Sherlock Holmes.
"Then, to whom was I introduced 3 years ago at Mrs. O'Connor's benefit party with Lady Wolseley?" The most logical guess, the only logical guess,
was that it was Jan Sigerson playing out his fantasy of being the written-about detective. But the Sherlock Holmes stories had not yet begun being published in the Strand in 1889. True, thought James, but he was vaguely aware of Goss or one of his Holmes fanatical friends mentioning that the first Holmes novel or novella, he was not sure which, A Study in Scarlet, had appeared as early as 1887, to be followed by, what was the title? The Sign of the Five? The Sign of the Four? Something like that. In Lippincott's magazine, 1889, Goss had said that the book version had come out the following year. Only after these initial forays into print did Sherlock Holmes begin to appear regularly in the Strand magazine. A demented Jan Sigerson would have heard much talk, both in England and on the continent, about the London detective. James later vaguely remembered something baked being brought for dessert, but whether he'd eaten a slice of cake or pie or baked Alaska, he later had no memory. The men gathered in John Hay's impressive study. Clara Hay and the Volebeck ladies had conferred and decided that they were not that interested in images of cold, high places. Hay, King, Sigerson, Emissary Volebeck, and James were served their brandy in the study. Servants had already set up a screen and Sigerson's rented magic lantern projector, all polished wood and brass, and had fueled and primed it. The men took their seats in various deep leather chairs or couches. James was so rattled that he drank off half his snifter of brandy without agitating it or inhaling the fumes in preparation. The silent servants drew the blinds and let themselves out. Sigerson ignited the projector lamp, and a rectangle of bright light illuminated the square screen that covered one wall of books.
"I only brought a few of my glass slides," said Jan Sigerson. "There are few crimes more heinous than boring one's audience."
"Bored by images of the Himalayan peaks and Tibet?" cried Clarence King. "I hardly think so."
"Clara will be sorry she missed this, and may ask for an encore," said Hay.
"I will be most happy to provide it," said Sigerson with a short, quick, Northern European bow. "The first image is of our approach to the Himalayas in northern Sikkim."
An image filled the screen.
"Dear God," cried King, "are those tiny specks beyond the moraine there men and mules?"
"Men and mules and Tibetan ponies, yes," said Sigerson.
"It gives one perspective on how truly astounding the Himalayan range is," said Mr. Volebeck.
"They make the Alps and the American Rocky Mountains look like molehills," said King.
"Here is the Yelap La that we mentioned earlier," said Sigerson. "La, of course, means pass in Tibetan."
An image changed to a line of small ponies and heavily bundled men, no more than 24, crossing boulder fields amidst near vertical snow slopes on either side.
"It seemed formidable at the time, but was no more than 14,000 feet at its summit."
The slide changed. The room was filled with the smell of the projector's limelight fuel.
"This is Tang La," said Sigerson. "The last real gateway before the forbidden kingdom of Tibet. Tang La, which means clear pass, was a bit more of a challenge since it is exposed to snow avalanches, even in the autumn when my small party attempted it, and its high point above 15,000 feet saw severe blizzards. You can see that both we and the ponies were liberally caked with ice."
"These photographs were not taken by Sigerson," thought James. "He's come into their possession somehow and passes them off as his own. But one always sees the Europeans and Tibetans from a distance. One can never make out the so-called Sigerson."
The next photograph was a close-up of Sigerson in padded clothing, mustache and eyebrows caked with ice, sitting astride one of the ponies. Behind him, out of focus but solid, was the trail down the pass to a high valley rimmed with countless giant peaks.
"The Tibetan pony is a tough little creature," said Sigerson, "but with emphasis on little, as much as on tough. As you can see, my boots constantly dragged on the ground. If the pony attempted to take me somewhere I did not want to go, I would simply stand up and let the pony run out from under me. At other times, if I did not want the pony to go somewhere it wanted to go, I would grab that uncomfortable-looking Tibetan wooden saddle and lift the pony off its hooves until we agreed on a direction."
The next photographic slide showed palm trees, tropical plants in giant pots, and Sigerson standing with a much younger blonde man on a terrace of some sort. Women in saris stood in the background.
"Sven Heden!" cried Mr. Helmer Halvorsen Volebeck. "Yes, I'm sorry," said Sigerson. "This slide is out of sequence. I asked an acquaintance to take this photo in Bombay when I stopped there to see Sven Anders Heden."
"May we inquire who Mr. Sven Anders Heden is?"
asked Clarence King, rising to pour himself more brandy from a decanter on a side table.
"Oh, Mr. Heden is one of Norway's most promising young explorers and alpinists," replied Mr. Volebeck.
"He is only 28, yet already he has shown glimpses of his great accomplishments to come."
"In Bombay, Sven told me that he decided to become an explorer when he was 15 years old," said Sigerson, stepping back from the heat rising from the projector's chimney. "He witnessed the triumphant return of our nation's great Arctic explorer, Adolf Erik Nordenskjöld, and then and there decided his future profession."
"I am surprised that young Heden did not cross the passes into Nepal with you, Mr. Sigerson," said Clarence King.
Sigerson nodded.
"Heden was seriously ill with recurring malaria when I visited him in Bombay," he said softly. "But this autumn, he should be embarked upon his first great quest, a multi-year exploration of Central Asia."
The large glass slide rasped in its mechanism, and the image on the screen changed. Most of the men in the room gasped.
"The Potala, the temple residence of the Dalai Lama in Lhasa, in the heart of Tibet," said Sigerson.
Henry James, who had also gasped at the photo, tried to take in the impossible scale of the palace. Were those saffron-colored specks at the bottom of the golden staircase actually human beings? As if reading his thoughts, Sigerson said,
"Yes, the scale of the Potala is hard to fathom, especially since the rest of Lhasa is so pathetic. Sagging mud and timber homes, endless narrow alleyways filled with dog carcasses and unspeakable refuse. But rising above all that, this. To give you a sense of its scale, all of Britain's Parliament would fit along the lower third of the Potala, with Big Ben rising only to the high point of the staircase. The temples and Lama's residences are all higher than that in the structure."
"I don't see how you did it, Mr. Sigerson,"
Clarence King said flatly.
"I just don't understand how you did it."
"Did what, Mr. King?"
"Got into Tibet, all the way to Lhasa. Scores of Europeans have tried it. None have succeeded. Surely you couldn't have disguised yourself as a Tibetan pilgrim, as so many of our explorers have, down to shaving one's head and wearing saffron rags. The Tibetan authorities always find them out. And you're far too tall to pass yourself off as a Tibetan."
Sigerson smiled.
"I did not disguise myself in any way. I simply told the sheriffs, warlords, soldiers, and palace police whom I met that I was a pilgrim."
And did your fellow travelers over the high passes also get to Lhasa? Asked John Hay.
No, they were all turned back near the border.
I don't understand, King said a final time.
The Norwegians are a persistent race, offered emissary Mr. Volebeck.
The last slide filled the screen. It was taken from a distance, but showed Sigerson sitting on a low boulder in a courtyard, talking to a young boy in a saffron robe. The brown-skinned lad's head was shaved, save for a single topknot, and his back was to the camera.
The 13th Dalai Lama, said Sigerson. He was 16 years old when I was allowed multiple audiences with him in the winter of 1891-92. The audiences were a double honor, since His Holiness was in seclusion away from the Potala, receiving intense and rigorous instruction for the role he was soon to assume.
I've read that most of the young Dalai Lamas don't live long enough to assume temporal power, said John Hay.
That is true, said Sigerson. The 9th through 12th Dalai Lamas all died young, many presumed to have been murdered by their acting regents, all of whom have a tendency to cling to power. This young man's predecessor, the 12th Dalai Lama, died after his regent arranged for his bedroom ceiling to collapse on him while he slept.
Mother of God, whispered King.
One of the few religious concepts that Tibetan Buddhists do not recognize in some form,
Sigerson said without any obvious irony.
May we ask what you discussed
with the 13th Dalai Lama?
Hay asked diffidently.
The nature of reality, said Jan Sigurdsson.
The Volebeck family was the first to depart. Handshakes and announcements that it had been a wonderful evening filled the huge mahogany-walled foyer. When Clarence King asked a servant to fetch his cape, hat, and walking stick, Sigerson surprised James, and the others, it seemed, by saying,
Could I please speak to you gentlemen in Mr. Hayes' study for 1 minute?
The study was still overheated and smelling of limelight, although servants had already removed the screen and bulky projector.
I have to go soon, grumped King. I have to travel to New York tomorrow before heading to Mexico, and...
This will only take a second, gentlemen, said Sigerson,
presuming the liberty of closing the door of Hayes' study behind him.
I need to talk to all of you tomorrow at 10 a.m., said Sigerson,
in a voice that James had not heard from him yet. If it was not a tone of absolute command, it was very close to it.
Mr. Hay, may I presume upon your good graces a final time to allow the meeting here in your study?
Well, yes, if it's a brief meeting.
It will be brief, said Sigerson.
Not possible, said Clarence King. I have the noon train to New York to meet, and several...
Mr. King,
Sigerson said softly,
I would not ask you to come back unless it were of extreme importance. One might say it is a matter of life and death, and it involves your friend, Mr. Henry Adams.
Hay and King looked at each other, and James could almost imagine the near telepathy at work between the old friends.
Damn it, man,
barked King.
Don't make a mystery out of it if it's something that involves Adams. Tell us now why you have us gathered here.
I'm sorry, but it must be tomorrow morning here at 10 o'clock, said Sigerson. I understand that Mrs. Hay will be out of the house for most of the day, so we will not be disturbed. Do I have your solemn promises that you will be here?
I also have plans to... began Henry James, and then stopped when he saw the hawk-like intensity of Sigerson's glance at him. The Norwegian was quite obviously mad as a hatter, and it seemed safer for James to play along with the others present than to become the sole object of the madman's attention. John Hay, Henry James and Clarence King promised to be there. King did not sound happy.
"Thank you,"
said Jan Sigerson, and opened the door to the study, as if releasing them all from his control, but only for the time being.